Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. Many years ago, several decades actually, an upstart by the name of Steve Reddy dared to bring a new trade show to the bicycle industry. Interbike became the largest and best-known bicycle trade show in the world. This week, the bike industry lost Steve Reddy. He'd been dealing with cancer for a very long time. At Interbike last September, Steve was able to get up in front of us, almost 300 of us, and speak about his experience and love for bicycles and those who work so hard to keep the industry fresh and vital here in the U.S. Steve will be missed by many, and his legacy lives on. So we are wrapping up what has to be one of the best Tours de France in a long, long time. Stage wins, polka dot jerseys, bonking, gritty climbs barely scratch the surface of this 100th edition of this most famous of events. My heart broke as I watched Jean-Christophe Perrault fall on a wet corner at the end of Stage 17's time trial, re-injuring his already broken clavicle from an earlier training ride that same morning. But France was redeemed when Christophe Riblon won the Lap d'Huez 18th stage a day later, just beating American TJ Van Garderen to the finish line. For those who want to believe that Chris Froome may have not run the race cleanly, you only had to see the pain and watch him falter climbing Lap d'Huez, losing considerable time and even taking a 20-second penalty, along with a fine, for taking on much-needed food with less than 20 kilometers to go. So tomorrow, the peloton rides down the Champs-Élysées, around the Arc de Triomphe, to the official finish of the Tour. It is second, third, fourth, and fifth place that are contested right now, but I would vote this as one of the best tours in many, many years. So moving on to this week's show, Travers Tygart became almost a household name at the height of the Lance Armstrong scandal last fall. He is the CEO of USADA, the U.S. anti-doping agency, and I thought having Travis talk about the U.S.'s role in anti-doping and the role of his agency, how racing is dealing with past scandal, and future athletes might fit in well this week. Travis is standing by to talk to me from his office in Colorado Springs. After we come back from a short break, I'll have a couple of interesting news items, and then I'll continue my Women in Cycling series with two amazing ladies. 53-year-old Shauna Hogan is a six-time Ram finisher and ultra cycling legend. Just to give you some idea of this lady, here are a few of her accomplishments. In 2012, she broke the overall women's 24-hour track record. She outpaced all of the women to win the Furnace Creek 508 and the Hoodoo 500. She established a new women's course record at the Hoodoo. Despite serious physical problems in her longest race in 15 years, she broke the women's 50-plus course record and was second overall in Race Across the West. 2012 culminated in a women's overall win at the 24-hour time trial World Championships. That was just 2012. And this year, while she encountered some serious respiratory issues around the 1,700-mile mark in Ram and had to drop out and receive medical assistance, she's on the mend and ready to talk with us this evening. Along with Shauna, it's a pleasure to welcome our own Cassie Schumacher. Cassie is the female winner of Ram this year. She's from the Akron area. She'll join the conversation right here in the studio with me. After a DNF in 2012, Cassie rode a tough and strong event from start to finish this year. So let's head on out to Colorado Springs and welcome Travis Tygart to the Outspoken Cyclist. Travis, thanks for joining me this evening.
Hey, great to be here, Diane. Thanks.
It's my pleasure. So my first question is a little bit about USADA itself. I'd like a little bit of history and background, when it was formed, why it was formed, and what it does.
Okay. Yeah, we were formed really a group of athletes back in the late 90s. Olympic athletes came forward and said, you know, we're tired of the perception that the U.S. Olympic team and all the other teams that are competing, you know, on behalf of whatever national governing body, USA Cycling or USA Swimming, whatever it may be, USA Track and Field, that they're perceived around the world as being dirty. And it was probably a little jealousy of other countries because we were winning all the medals. But there were also some cases that had gone forward and several that didn't go forward that kind of bred this perception that the U.S. wasn't doing, you know, what it should be doing with respect to ensuring clean athletes were playing on our teams. And so Congress, in conjunction with the United States Olympic Committee, heard from these athletes and decided to essentially externalize the program that used to be run by the United States Olympic Committee. So USADA, in late 2000, right after the Sydney Olympic Games, was set up as a 501c3 not-for-profit. So we're not a government agency, although we do receive some government funding. We also receive private funding from the United States Olympic Committee, but also other entities that we provide services to. And we essentially, by private contract, every athlete, whether you know, run in the New York Marathon, for example, that happens to be, you know, monitored by or sanctioned by USA Track and Field, or whether you're on a Tour de France cycling team, you have to have a membership or a license in the sport, USA Cycling if you're a pro cyclist, USA Track and Field if you're running in the New York Marathon, and you essentially agree to the rules that govern the playing field, and those rules include, you know, the 100-meter dash is 100 meters, and you can't use a moped to run it. And similarly, you can't use these performance-enhancing drugs in order to gain an advantage covertly to perform in it. And if you have a positive test or if there's other evidence, documents, eyewitnesses, financial records, lab results, whatever it may be that demonstrates, you know, to the legal standard that you've committed a violation, then the process is what we then ultimately run. Most importantly, I think, Diane, our job hopefully is to deter. And we try to do that through education and prevention programs to really try to convince athletes that, look, there is no victory in cheating to win. And just because you might get a trophy, if you've done that because, you used a cork bat in baseball or had a motor on your bike in cycling or used EPO in marathon running, and that's how you accomplished your trophy, then you're really no winner. You're actually just a cheater and a fraud. And so we really try to convey that message effectively so that athletes don't make the unfortunate decision to cheat with these dangerous drugs and cheat sport.
Do you think athletes on their own make these decisions? Where are young athletes? Let's talk about youngsters coming up in the sport, because what's, you know, we're hoping that we start to see something changing at the top echelon. But when we're looking down below at kids coming in from the high school level, let's say, and then into college and then going on to either do pro sports or continue running or racing or riding or whatever they're doing, are there other external influences that are introducing them to these substances? For example, coaches, doctors, you know, soignés. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think we're naive to think that there aren't those within the system that either encourage it or directly provide it or pressure or to some extent persuade athletes to the level of coercion that's the only way that they can win. I think you also can't underestimate just this cultural influence of the win at all costs. And while, you know, it's hard to believe someone would, you know, overtly approach a 14, 15-year-old inline roller skater, for example, a real-life case that we had, what we did see is a dad and a coach who put an awful lot of pressure, and then ultimately the kid said, I want to do whatever it takes to win, and they then gave him access to one of the most sophisticated programs that we've seen of human growth hormone, insulin, testosterone. And again, not a fame sport, not a money sport, but all because the dad wanted to walk around corporate America where he was every day and brag and feed his ego that his son was the top inline roller skater in the country. And I think we have to be realistic about the pressures at the youth sport level. I mean, I've mentioned this before, but my 8-year-old daughter a few years ago, she's 11 now, but when she was swimming on the summer club swim team, you know, we saw parents shoving Monster and other energy drinks down their 8-year-old kids' throats, telling them, you look tired, you're not swimming fast enough. And it's that slippery slope of these pressures that we put on athletes that ultimately, you know, the ones that maybe are weak, the ones that are hyper-competitive, they can go through that justification to say, well, if there's no testing program in place, like in high school or like in college, which is, you know, while they claim to have one, it's wholly inadequate, they're gonna easily justify it. because that's what this culture dictates that they do, and that's really unfortunate. But I think it also, Diane, backs up our approach in our cycling investigation, which from day one was never about the athletes. In fact, while, of course, the athletes made their own decisions, and they were many times, grown men, although many of them were young men, 18, 19, 20 years old, and they made their decisions, and they had to be held accountable as appropriate under the rules. At the end of the day, goal one for us was to dismantle the system, those within the sport structure, whether team owners, doctors, trainers, people within the sport, who allowed this, you know, deep and broad doping culture to exist in the sport, and really didn't, you know, fulfill what we believe was their fiduciary duty to ensure that it didn't happen. And we were determined, as we still are today, which is why we've been very both vocal and also working hard behind the scenes to try to move the sport, the professional side of sport, of cycling, into a new direction, to put a stake in the ground that truly changes the culture as best we can and starts it afresh going forward for young up-and-coming athletes.
Well, you know, one can hope, and hopefully that some of the things that have been put in place are beginning to take root. Everybody's watching the tour right now, and it's been quite an interesting event, and it looks a little different from what it did a few years ago. In fact, it looks a lot different to me, even though people are still coming out and saying, oh, you know, Froome is cheating, Froome can't do this. Of course, you know, this stage, he's sort of floundered, so maybe things are not exactly as they seem. So let's talk a little bit about the Lance Armstrong case and why USADA is the organization. You also have WADA. You have the World Anti-Doping, and I'm kind of trying to figure out how they work together and then how you came up with this reasoned decision and also why the case got dropped at the highest level. But we'll get to that. So tell me about how Lance became the bad boy. He wasn't the first. He wasn't the only cheater. But what was it about him from your perspective that made this so important to make it so high profile?
Well, I guess first taking a step back, I mean, our effort was never about Lance Armstrong.
Okay.
And someone once asked me, when did your Lance Armstrong investigation start? Well, it didn't. We had a witness back in, you know, April of 2010, who was a former teammate of Armstrong,
right,
who came forward, Floyd Landis, and this has all, you know, been public and it's in our reasoned decision, but came forward and gave us, you know, a whole lot of information, evidence, allegations that went from U.S. Postal to other teams within the pro peloton during the time period that Floyd operated. And we listened. And what we said is, look, Floyd, as long as you're truthful, number one, and as long as you're full and complete, so you can't, you know, not tell us about the people you like still that are competing, and then tell
right.
us only about the people you don't like.
Right.
So that's a you know, what any time a witness comes forward, we say you need truthfulness and complete. Can't hold anything back, and you have to be truthful. So, and then our obligation then is to follow up. So we then followed up on that information, and a lot of it was quickly confirmed by a few other witnesses that came forward, and so we began to see a picture that was painted, which was a pro peloton during that time period that a whole lot of the athletes involved, including the top American riders, but as well as foreign athletes, were involved, and that, you know, the U.S. Postal Services team, but also other teams, ran drug programs to success. And so we just followed the evidence where it led us, and then ultimately, you know, we decided to give every athlete, including Lance Armstrong, an opportunity to come in and be part of the solution, meaning that, look, to a certain extent, while the athletes made their decision, when they were confronted with the options, saying, look, we're going to, you know, have to bring a case against you because we have all this evidence and you cheated sport, or you can come in and be part of the solution and we'll do our best under the rules as long as you're truthful to us and complete in your information. We really want to ensure that the system that allowed this to happen is dismantled to the extent that we can, because we don't want to be here for the next 10 or 15 years just punishing individual athletes when it's those around them that are the ones ultimately, we believe, more culpable in the system allowing it to go on. And we really won't make any headway unless we do that. And so after a lot of thought, our team decided that made all the sense in the world. So we gave every athlete, as I said, including Lance Armstrong, that opportunity. He was the only athlete that we approached that decided not to come in and sit down and be truthful with us. And as a result, we ended up bringing a case against, you know, the co-conspirators of the U.S. Postal Services that we had at the time. The evidence, you know, clearly showed their doping, as we said in our reasoned decision, you know, against him beyond a reasonable doubt, really no doubt, given the totality of the evidence against him. And it was our obligation under the rules and given the mandate that we have to clean athletes to move forward with the case. And, you know, while his got a lot of notoriety in large part because of his decision not to come in and be part of the solution and for his decision to attack us, go to the Hill, go to the media, go to, you know, federal court to try to stop us from doing our job, at the end of the day, the truth prevailed and the evidence speaks for itself. But we are still on our goal, which is to dismantle the system. And while, again, the Lance Armstrong portion of it is over, we're still working with national anti-doping organizations around the world and pushing UCI as best we can to actually do a global solution to put the sport on a new foundation to move it forward. Because we truly believe that's the only way to unshackle the sport from its past. Because if you've got people in the sport today that used drugs in the past with success, and that's the only way they knew success, they're more likely to do that today. And while certainly there's heightened sensitivity today in the sport because of our recent reasoned decision, our fear is in a year or two or three, people forget, memories fade, and people don't appreciate the gravity of the situation and the culture that had taken over the sport. And so we really aren't going to be fulfilled with our goal for clean athletes unless we try to continue to effectuate, you know, significant change to the sport that doesn't allow this culture to continue on.
I'd like to take a moment to remind listeners, I'm speaking with Travis Tigard. He is the CEO of USADA, the U.S. anti-doping agency. He's in his offices in Colorado Springs. So let me try to understand where we are today and putting the Tour de France to rest, the whole 2013 cycling season. And a few people have been tossed out. I mean, every once in a while you hear somebody tested positive. So we know it's still going on. We're in the U.S. and your job is in the U.S. What happens when a U.S. rider, and he's riding for a team in Europe, your arm only reaches into what he's doing, but it isn't really reaching into what the rest of the team is doing. Am I understanding that correctly?
No.
Okay.
The UCI rules, which are in line with the WADA rules, say that whichever entity, National Anti-Doping Agency like USADA or the one in Italy or the one in France or whomever, discovers, and that's the key word, discovers the violation, has authority to bring the disciplinary process. And so we discovered the evidence against Michele Ferrari because we had, you know, emails, we had eyewitness testimony, we had lab documents that all corroborated and proved that he was giving doping advice in violation of the rules to riders, both U.S. and other riders. And so since we discovered that evidence, we then had the jurisdiction under the rules, the UCI rules, to bring the case against Michele Ferrari.
Wow. I did not understand that. And I'll bet I would say 90% of the people listening did not understand that. That is very interesting. So you actually, your arm can reach out to whoever. So somebody in Italy could have discovered it and done it under whatever the Italian anti-doping agency is.
That's right. The WADA code world rule says whoever discovers the violation has results management authority. And the UCI rule mimics that as well. So, look, I mean, you know, primary jurisdiction for testing should rely on those national anti-doping organizations of athletes in those countries.
Right.
We can test our athletes, like, you know, when they're living in Girona training, for example, or wherever they are around the world. We can only test our U.S. athletes. We can also test foreign athletes who are here in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
Training and, you know, in sports like swimming and track and field, a number of top foreign athletes are in the college ranks. And a number of, you know, track and field long distance runners, for example, train in the United States. And so we have jurisdiction, even though they're not U.S. member athletes, because they're foreign athletes of a foreign national federation. Under the WADA code rules, we can test them while they're here. So from a testing standpoint, obviously it's those in your country or that are citizens or members of your national federations. But from a evidence standpoint, non-analytical is what we call it, whoever discovers the violation, and in this case we discovered the violations because so many of these witnesses came forward to us.
Okay, I understand. I think I do. So let me ask a question about the extent of USADA when it comes to sport in general, not necessarily just cycling. So when I read sort of what USADA does, and you have control of U.S. Olympic, Paralympic, Pan-American, and Para-Pan-American sport, you also talk about things even at the high school level. So those aren't the only things you oversee, just the Olympics and the Paralympics and Pan-American games. You also oversee track and field in high schools, in colleges, in pro, right?
The term Olympic, Paralympic, and Pan Am, mostly Olympic and Paralympic, have taken on, in most U.S. Fans' eyes, a very narrow, only happens summer every 4 years, winter every 4 years.
Right.
But it's much broader than that. So, for example, I mentioned the New York Marathon previously.
Right.
That is an event where, tens of thousands of people run in it. Boston Marathon, we were there testing this year, for example. Those events are sanctioned by USA Track and Field. So that necessarily makes them, for purposes of Olympic sport and amateur athletic competition, that we have jurisdiction for. And so there are hundreds, if not thousands, of those types of events that happen around the country. Now, high school football, for example, football is not an Olympic sport, and it's high school. We have no jurisdiction of that. NCAA college football or even college track and field, we don't have jurisdiction of that. But many of our athletes who also compete in USA track and field events, nationals, world championships, Olympics, they also run in the college system. So we can test those individual athletes who are members of USA track and field even while they're competing in the college ranks.
Interesting. Now I understand much better. Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the case of a father being, so into having his kid be number one, and this was a different sport. So when we look at all of the sports today, is there anything as pervasive as it seemed that cycling was with doping? Is there anything that we are not hearing about that you're investigating? Just out of a curiosity question.
Obviously I can't comment on open or ongoing investigations.
Right.
But look, I think cycling, the evidence, some would argue, and I got this question back in 03, 04 with Balco and track and field.
Okay.
And at the time, my answer was the same. We have the evidence. I think it's really unfair to speculate or use rumor or innuendo or even individual performances to, without, full evidence and a legal process. Every athlete, and I think it's a failure on all of our parts, including ourselves, when athletes are unfairly questioned just because of a performance or whatever it may be that they're doping. I think a few rotten apples have tainted the whole bunch to a certain extent. And if you are a clean athlete, all athletes deserve that presumption. And unless and until through the established legal process, I think people should believe until that process dictates and determines that they shouldn't believe any longer. And that's how it was, obviously, in our Lance Armstrong case. We were all huge fans, and we have an obligation to follow up on the evidence. But at the end of the day, everyone is presumed innocent unless and until the evidence shows differently.
I so appreciate you saying that, because that's been my stance on Facebook since the tour began. People are just, I think people like the whole gossipy part of it. So let me ask a question about amnesty. It's been a big question. Should there be amnesty? I know people are serving suspensions right now, and some are coming back, some are retiring. Do you believe that amnesty is a good idea?
We pushed for it. And really, since the beginning of this, we were hopeful that there was going to be some process, whether it's amnesty, whether it's truth and reconciliation, limited immunity, whatever you call it. And there's a lot of devil in the detail that has to be worked out. That said, we think it was worth the effort because we are fearful that the sport is just going to try to move forward, sweep all this era, try to categorize this as an era of the past, and fail to recognize that there are still many, we believe, whether team directors, coaches, otherwise, in the system that were part of the system of the past. And as I said earlier, if you doped in the past, which many did, you're more likely to dope today, and certainly more likely to dope in the future. So why not put a stake in the ground? You know, the truth of those stories are going to come out drip by drip by drip by drip. So why not have a definitive process, take, yes, somewhat bold, yes, somewhat courageous, but put a stake in the ground and let, a well thought through and defined process give athletes, not people within the sport, not coaches, team doctors, not people in a fiduciary role to athletes, the athlete protectors. They don't get some sort of amnesty necessarily. They could. But assumably their violations, if there were any, were so egregious, given their role as the protectors of athletes, that they don't deserve it. But the athletes themselves ought to be given an opportunity to come in, and as we did with our 11 former U.S. Postal Service riders, including the offer to Lance Armstrong, come in and be part of the solution and give the athletes a break for just participating in this anarchy culture that existed. And let's finally put a stake in the ground to help the sport move forward for the good.
From your mouth to God's ears, that would be awesome. I would love to see that happen, and I appreciate you saying so. So what do you see future-wise? I mean, it would be wonderful to think that your job is done, but obviously that's probably never going to happen. What do you see future-wise? We have a Winter Olympics coming up soon. Obviously, you are testing and continuing to monitor. Do you see any changes since all of this has happened?
We have. I mean, I think athletes have realized that no team or person is too big to fail, and I think that gives clean athletes an awful lot of hope in competing and knowing that they can do it right. And if they are fearful. That others aren't out there doing it right. And that's the biggest reason you hear athletes who succumb to the temptation is they feel like they have no choice because others within their sport are doing it and aren't being held accountable. And so I think this case demonstrates, and our investigation demonstrates, that, look, we're going to be overly fair, but we also are going to do the hard, complex, dirty work that clean athletes deserve us to do. And we're going to follow through on the evidence that's there and hold whoever it is accountable if they violate the rules. So that in turn gives confidence, gives reassurance, hopefully gives renewed hope that the athletes who don't otherwise want to cheat, confidence that they don't have to cheat. And if they're confronted with it, there's an opportunity to come forward to an independent organization here at USADA and express the information, and they're going to follow up on it responsibly. I mean, I think the whistleblower example that you saw with the initial athlete that came forward should give all people confidence. And we have to have athletes out there today and coaches and team doctors who are doing it the right way. We have to have them embrace clean sport. And this story, I think, this case rather, I think demonstrates that there is an entity that is here for them. And we our doors and our phones are wide open for them to come forward and let us help you keep your culture of your sport, because you're the one that's getting cheated. If you're a clean athlete, you're the victim. So we're here to advocate for your rights.
Well, I think we will end on that note, but I certainly appreciate you talking to me about USADA and about what happened and hopefully what will be happening going forward. It'll be nice to see youngsters coming up in the sport, hopefully not being threatened. And that's sort of what it's like. They're being threatened to have to achieve something. So it'd be nice if they could just go and play and enjoy their sports. So thank you.
Couldn't agree anymore, Diane. And at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do. We inherited, sports. We remember a lot of money influence and these drugs have flown into sports over the prior, you know, 2 to 3 decades before our existence. So it takes a little time, but I think we've got a new generation of athletes who have seen, don't want to be the next Marion Jones to have 5 medals removed because they intentionally cheated.
Right.
And those are powerful examples that I think in turn weigh on young athletes' minds. And I think we are, you know, hopeful that we've got a new generation of athletes who want to do it right and know that there's something more to competing at the top and winning than just getting a trophy.
Travis, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you, have a great afternoon. You as well.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Travis Tygart joined me from his offices in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I'm going to take a short break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
It started out like a totally normal day.
I love you.
I mean, I guess I was a little sweaty, and I was definitely sore. I thought I had gas. Turns out, I was having a heart attack. Heart disease is the number one killer of American women. So now I take care of myself and tell the other women in my life to do the same. Make it your mission to save your life and the lives of the women you love. Find out more from the American Heart Association at goredforwomen.org.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. So my first news item comes from right here in Ohio, from the state capitol, actually. So after much anticipation, Columbus had a soft launch of their bike share system this week. Here's a report from Channel 10 News. A new green and affordable way to get around downtown Columbus will soon be available to residents. The new Kogo bike share system was kicked off Wednesday by Columbus Mayor Michael B. Coleman, City Council member Zach Klein, and Jeff Olson of Alta Bike Share. There will be a total of 30 stations installed and made operational by early August. So I thought that was nice. Columbus is finally getting theirs off the ground, and we'll see if Cleveland weighs in on a bike share in any time soon. So then there is this "Did This Really Happen?" story out of New Jersey, when Emily Krause and her boyfriend Joe, who were late for the Dave Matthews Band concert, decided to take a different, less congested route to the show and encountered a guy with a flat tire standing by the side of the road. Joe said, "That's Dave Matthews," who it turns out had no cell phone and evidently nothing to fix his own bike, like a tube or, you know, patch kit or anything like that. Luckily for everyone, Emily's dad had recently put a bike rack on the back of the car, so good Samaritans that they were, Emily and Joe chauffeured Dave to the concert. They were then treated to terrific seats, signed tickets, and dinner with the star. So I guess it pays to stop and pick up people off of the road if they break down with their bike. So continuing with my Women in Cycling theme shows, this story comes from Velo News. Several of pro cycling's top women have sent a letter and online petition to Tour de France boss Christian Prudhomme, asking him to include women in the race starting in 2014. Spearheading the effort is multiple discipline world champion Marianne Vos, Olympic silver medalist Emma Pooley, 3-time St. Kitts and Nevis national champion Catherine Bertin, and 4-time Ironman world champion Chrissy Wellington. There was once a women's Tour de France known as La Grande Boucle Féminine, or just Tour Féminine, which ran from 1984 to 2009, though it was not directly associated with the men's tour and annually struggled for sponsorship dollars. The letter and petition, which had gathered over 4,000 signatures by last Friday, respectfully requests that a women's professional field be added to the 2014 Tour de France, which is owned and operated by the Paris-based Amaury Sports Organization. They are not really asking to race with the men. They are asking for a parallel race. And we'll see what happens. I mean, it's worth watching, I think. So this is my favorite good story of the week. It was posted in a lot of places. I picked it up from the UK's Daily Mail online site by a journalist named Alex Grieg. Pennsylvania teens chase down kidnapper's car on their bikes and save 5-year-old girl. Two Pennsylvania teens are being hailed as heroes after they chased down a man in a car who had snatched a 5-year-old girl from her grandmother's front yard on their bikes. Jocelyn Rojas, 5, was missing for 2 hours when Tamar Boggs and a friend saw the child in a car near Lancaster Township and gave chase. After Boggs, 15, and his friend had been tailing the vehicle for 15 minutes, the driver let the little girl out of the car and took off. Now that the little girl is safely back with her family, police are focusing on finding the suspect. Boggs spotted the girl in the abductor's car and said he and his friend began to follow him. I don't know if that's a great idea, but evidently he was 15 and fearless. The high school student said the little girl ran towards him when she got out of the car. If he wasn't going to stop, I was probably going to, like, jump on the car, Boggs told ABC6. Boggs said the suspect kept turning around to see if they were still following him after they began to give chase. As soon as the guy started noticing that we were chasing him, he stopped at the end of the hill, let her out, and she ran to me and said she needed her mom. Boggs took the little girl to the police. They contacted her frantic mother and family. Police say the teens may have scared the abductor into giving the girl up, and their bravery is being praised by the girl's family and police. I guess so. That's pretty awesome. That's pretty awesome. He is a hero. My last item for this evening, we're going to kind of come back around to the anti-doping agency. Two men have been charged with directing threats toward U.S. Anti-Doping Agency CEO Travis Tygart in the aftermath of USADA's decision to strip cyclist Lance Armstrong of his Tour de France titles. One indictment, unsealed Thursday, alleges that Garrett Keats of Clearwater, Florida, threatened Tygart via interstate communication in October. Another, unsealed on Friday, makes the same charge against Robert Hutchins of Sandy, Utah. That indictment says Hutchins made the threat last August 23rd, the same day Armstrong announced that he wasn't going to fight the USADA sanctions for doping. I've been subjected to a 2-year federal criminal investigation followed by Travis Tygart's unconstitutional witch hunt, the cycle said in a letter to the agency. Keats was arrested Thursday in Clearwater, Hutchinson's on Tuesday in Salt Lake. Both are scheduled to make appearances in federal court in Denver on July 29th. Making threats via interstate commerce carries up to a 5-year prison sentence and a $250,000 fine. Public records identify Keats as a urologist, born in 1941 with a clear and active medical license. Shortly after Armstrong said he wouldn't fight the USADA sanction, Tygart revealed he had received death threats and was asking the FBI to investigate. So I guess that is how we're going to end the news. We start with Travis Tygart this week. We end with Travis Tygart in the news. We are going to move right along and get ourselves with Cassie right here in the studio. And we're going to talk with Shauna Hogan, who's out on the West Coast. So, Shauna, 6-time Ram winner. Cassie, female Ram winner for 2013. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for letting us come on the show. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, you too, Cassie. It's fun. Always fun having somebody in the studio. And you're right here. Shauna, you are out in California?
Yes, out in California in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
Nice. Nice. I'll bet it's cooler there than it is here today. We've got like a gazillion degrees.
Oh, I doubt it. It's going to be over 100 today, I think.
Okay, then. Maybe we'll just stay right here. First, Shauna, I just want to ask you how you're feeling. During Ram this year, first time, I guess, you're a 6-time finisher. You had some respiratory problems. What happened?
Well, there was a dust storm in Monument Valley, and my crew tried to get me to wear a mask, and I didn't do it, so that was a big mistake in retrospect.
So you are recovered?
Yeah.
But you did have to drop out of the race this year?
Yeah, it was getting to be too much, and I thought, and I wasn't really planning to do Ram 2013, I was planning to do Ram 2014. I basically threw the race together in the last couple of months. I didn't decide to do it until April. So the DNF was actually pretty good because it reminded me of how difficult Ram actually is. I'd forgotten it. It's kind of like my childbirth, I think. You kind of forget how hard it is. You know?
Yeah, I never mind. I don't want to remember that either. So tell us a little bit about your background. When you started riding and competing, you are in your 50s now?
Yeah, I'm 53.
Awesome.
I started riding in 1992. Well, started racing in 1992. That was my first Ram, was 1992. So I was about 32, 33 at that time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm going to get back to you in 1 second. I want to ask Cassie a couple of questions. Again, it's so nice to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to see you, too.
So in 2012, you were a DNF on Ram and decided you wanted to go back and finish. What happened in 2012 and what changed so that you got through it this year, and we watched every second of it.
Yeah, yeah. And it was so great to have all the support back home. You know, what happened in last year's race, you know, I got hit with the trifecta, diarrhea, you know, throwing up and heat exhaustion all at the same time. And, you know, I had some crew that were committed to me, but really didn't know how to respond to those things. So I never really fully recovered. And their answers to solving some of those problems weren't right for me. And, you know, it led to me never really recovering. And, you know, you want to live to race another day.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it was just, you know, I just was so exhausted. And, you know, it was a great learning experience.
So you were able to come back in 2013 and make it happen.
Right.
So, Shauna, tell us a little bit about your background and what compelled you to get into ultra distance racing as opposed to, saying, just track racing or road or mountain.
Well, basically, I was a rider that just rode centuries and double centuries, you know, at the time. And I never thought about racing, actually, because I was kind of afraid of the close packs and things like that. And I don't know, I rode a quadruple century with a friend of mine after I rode my first double century, and I was able to stay with him, and I finished under 24 hours. And so, you know, people were encouraging me to race Ram, and I hadn't really heard of it at the time. And I was encouraged. I did the qualifier, and I qualified, and I did Ram the next year. That was 1992.
So you did a quadruple century. Who even knew there was such a thing? I mean, I know about doubles, and I know about, you know, crazy stuff like rain in Indiana and rainstorm and all of that, but 400 miles in one day, huh?
Yeah, well down here, there's the LA Wheelmen it's called the Grand Tour, and they have a 200, 300, and 400-mile options, and they have a highland and lowland option of each. So one has more climbing, one has less climbing. And I hadn't heard of it before, and I just did it. And I was only planning to do 300, but the last 100 miles is supported. They require that. And I was riding with a friend of mine, like I said, and I just couldn't see sitting in the van for 6 hours. So I decided to stay on his wheel and just ride the additional 100.
So when you do these kinds of events, and I really believe it's some kind of a special gift that people who can sort of endure through these long races, where do you get that grit? Where do you reach down and find that, oh, I can do this? Do you say to yourself, I can do this? Or do you just go out and do it?
Sometimes it's just going out and doing it and just having your mind on the finish line and just getting to the finish line. And there are times in between where you have to say to yourself, I can do this. I can do this. So there's actually two things going on. There's that finish line that you know you want to get to, you know, and you've got that focus. But then in between times, as you run into difficulties, you have to say to yourself, I can do this, I can do this. And you have to have a good crew to say you can do this, to remind you, you can do this, you're strong, you know, it's just a temporary lull, and keep on going.
Well, and that brings us back to Cassie, because I know before we got started, we were talking about the crew and how important it is to have the right people behind you. And right at the beginning of the show, you know, you're telling us about your trifecta. So what did you find difficult this year and yet we're still able to endure, Cassie? What kinds of problems? You didn't run into the same weather problems, I don't think, as last year either, right? Or did you?
Oh, I mean, it was like maybe 2 degrees cooler.
Okay, no big deal.
I ran into all the same problems. They just didn't all happen at the same time this year. And I had people that were able to problem solve without getting stressed out. You know, I mean, everything that happened to me could have become really serious unless people responded. Like when I was in the desert, I started getting the chills and I knew that I needed to get off the bike because I'm getting cold and it's 113 degrees out.
Right.
So I, you know, jumped in the van and, you know, they iced me up and, you know, and I just got my core temperature back to normal. You know, I mean, it was just people knowing how to respond really quickly. You know, I don't know, Shauna, if this has happened to you, but I had a lot of problems retaining water in my legs. So, you know, it got to the point where, you know, when I was sleeping, I'd be in such pain, I'd wake up screaming and, you know, just unbearable pain. So what ended up happening is I had to get off my bike a couple times a day and just lay on my back, and somebody would hold my legs, and then, you know, two people would rub bottles and pull out the water. You know, I mean, that's stuff that would never happen to you on a century or a double century ride.
Right.
What was causing your fluid retention? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I had symptoms of it last year, but this year it was pretty bad. I don't know. I'm calling it Schumacher syndrome because I don't know anybody else that's had it that bad.
Interesting. So we can add this to the RAM, the annals of the RAM information. Schumacher syndrome, when you retain water in your legs.
Right.
So I have some questions I'd like to ask you both. And we'll start with you, Shauna, because you've been doing it a little bit longer. If you were to offer advice to a woman who was interested in becoming a more serious cyclist, what would be the way she might get into not just endurance riding, but getting back on a bike and riding? What would you tell a woman today who says, wow, I like what those women are doing. What can I do to start doing that?
Well, I think the first thing that a person needs is balance. Right in your life, because I know me, I've got a family, I've got a job, and I've got training, and you have to balance that in order to be successful. Because if you can't balance it, then something's gonna give, and if it's your family or your job, then you can't really train. So, So the balance is really important, and in order to be competitive, you have to have a supportive family. Absolutely, you have to have a supportive family. If you want to go into just recreational riding, then you know your family is definitely important, but the training doesn't have to be as hard. You know, you don't have to go out as much. It's not as imperative to do every day. You know, if you want to do a short road racing type racing, then the training itself doesn't take as much time. You're doing more intense workouts and fewer long workouts. So a person has to base it on their current life and how much time they have to actually train. So if you want to do endurance training, you have to have a really supportive family and a job that's flexible as well.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with two women Race Across America finishers, Shauna Hogan, who is a six-time finisher, Cassie Schumacher, right here from the Akron, Ohio area, who finished this year. So good to see you, by the way, Cassie, again. So, Cassie, what about you? Same question. So if a woman came to you and said, you know, I really think what you did was cool, I'd like to get into it, what would you tell her?
You know, how I got into ultra racing, you know, I kind of came out of long course triathlon, and I was just becoming really disenchanted with the people. And what I really fell in love with in ultra cycling, and I just met a couple ultra cyclists. Your dog is not happy.
Hey, Gromit. I'm sorry. Yeah, Gromit
just got bit by a rattlesnake last
week. He's up
and at him. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poor puppy.
So he sounds like he's back to normal.
Yeah, he is. I just escaped to the other room. Sorry,
Kathy. It's okay. You know, but in Ohio, you know, most people don't know about RAM. I mean, where Shauna lives, it's kind of saturated with, you know, ultra cycling because of the weather is so much better. But most people in Ohio don't know about RAM. So I found out about it on a bike tour in southern Ohio. I met Danny Chu, and I also Eric Overton. I know he's been on your show, and he's a local guy that from the Cleveland area that does a lot of local ultra racing. And, you know, I got into it and I really fell in love with the people and the sport. And, you know, I'm more of an endurance athlete than a short distance. And, you know, most of the local endurance races are a lot cheaper than Ironman. And then I went on the ultra cycling website, the UMCA's website, and started poking around and, you know, discovered Susan Notarangelo and Shauna Hogan, you know, women that set a high bar in ultra cycling and read their stories on the Hall of Fame. And I'm like, wow, you know.
I want to be like that.
And, you know, I mean, not only did Shauna, you know, finish Ram six times, she's won it six times.
Right.
I mean, and she holds the record in wins, right, Shauna, with both men and women?
Not for Ram, but for San Francisco to Los Angeles and Seattle to San Diego, I have the overall records for those.
Okay.
And for Cassie, I'd like to say that she won Ram this year, but the woman who came in front of her was on a recumbent bicycle. So Cassie won the standard bike division on Ram this year, and she and Ram itself has always been a standard bicycle race.
Right, right.
So, in fact,
I was surprised to see a recumbent rider in the event this year.
Yeah, so that's important to note that Cassie has the championship in my eyes.
Oh, thank you, Shauna.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So let me ask a question about financing, because becoming involved in cycling at the outset is not inexpensive. I mean, once you have good equipment, it will last a long time. But you also have entry fees. You also have, in the case of Ram, you have crew, you have food, you have gas, you have all this stuff. How did you, Cassie, how were you able to finance this? And you also have a charity involved with your
mm-hmm.
event.
Yeah.
You raised money for your charity.
Yeah, and man, financing Ram is not easy. I mean, that's why a lot of people don't do it. But I just really, you know, I just had in my mind that I wanted to do it. And I had somebody that was on my crew that was supposed to be doing fundraising. And I found out at the end of April that he hadn't raised any money. And so I was like, what am I going to do? You know, and luckily I have good friends that had sponsored me the year before and said that they would sponsor me. So Monreal Funeral Home was very generous and gave me $6,000
wow.
toward my race. And Jerry Lynch, who I co-founded Pedal for Heroes with, he is a really great guy and well-connected in the business community, and he started knocking on doors, and he was able to raise the other part for us to do Ram. And as far as my charity goes, one thing I really learned from raising money for a charity last year is that it's very time consuming. So I wanted to focus during Ram as using it as an opportunity to raise awareness for veterans issues. So now I'm doing the fundraising piece.
Oh, okay. As opposed to focusing on fundraising during Ram.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
I focused on sponsorship during to get me to the starting line and take care of it. Now I'm trying to raise money for my charity.
So, Shauna, you have a family, you have a job, and you have to finance these events. How do you balance all of that as far as financial
means goes? Well, this year was my first year over 10 years doing it.
Uh-huh.
So I haven't had a huge burden, you know, and I'm older now and, you know, more financially stable and
right.
just more able to do it than I was in my 30s. In my 30s, I got some good sponsorship deals and I was able to keep coming back because of the cash sponsorship I was getting.
I wish we had more time to just expand on all of this, but do you have a quick story you could tell, Shauna, that might entice people to get involved, something that sort of is heartwarming to you about your racing career?
Well, the people involved, of course, because Ram, anyone who's done Ram, let me put it this way, people who haven't done Ram don't realize what an epic event it is.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've done it, you automatically get this sisterhood and brotherhood with all the other people who have done it, because we are the only ones who understand. And crews don't understand. Nobody really understands, but the riders. And so there's this this family that develops, and you have this this thing in common. And when you see other Ram riders or meet other Ram riders, there's an understanding. And I really like that. I like
that's
that
nice.
Camaraderie.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. Cassie, what do you have to say different from that?
You know, I would agree with that. You know, the story of how I met up with Shauna is I just sent her a Facebook message and kind of said, hey, I'm going to be out in California. Can I go come out and ride? And, you know, and she was just really gracious and invited me to ride with her at her home. And, you know, it was just amazing to learn from her. And it is a family, definitely. You know, I've got amazing friends through ultra cycling because it's just, it's a common bond that most people can't even imagine. You know, the things that a Ram rider goes through. I mean, I think there are a lot of arrogant people out there that think, oh, I could ride my bike across the country and do it way faster than that. But it's not about really, it's about staying on the bike, but it's about overcoming adversity. And that's what life is about.
Yeah. Because basically Ram becomes an analogy for life. You know, it's just that you experience the highest highs and the lowest lows in that 2 week period. And it's pretty amazing.
Well, I can only imagine and vicariously watch it from my perspective. I mean, we did follow Tractalis, I think, is the website, and I followed it every day, all the time, and it was always wonderful to say, oh, wait, she stopped. Oh, wait, she's on her bike. You know, we were watching it all the time. So, Shauna, what are your plans for 2014? Are you going to go back and do Ram again?
I'm thinking about it. It really depends on money and crew. I had some crew issues this year, and I want to make sure that I don't have those same issues again.
Okay.
So I want to make sure that at least half of my crew has Ram experience. So I'm working on that now. So I've started now, and we'll see if I can raise funds because I don't want to dip too much into my bank account this year and get some more sponsorship.
Get that. And you, Miss Cassie, you've got plans for 2014. Doesn't have to be Ram. Do you have any special events you're going to be doing next year?
I don't have anything on my radar.
Okay.
You know, I think I'll do some qualifiers, but Ram is just, it's a lot. It's not only a huge financial commitment, it's a huge time commitment. I mean, you're giving up 20 to 40 hours of your life just training. You know, I can pretty for sure say it's not on my radar for next year. You know, I want to enjoy life. It's great being back to being a normal human being.
I'm not sure Ram finishers are ever really normal.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, you know what? It's been delightful talking to both of you, and I wish you a lot of luck with whatever your next endeavor is, on the bike, off the bike. Thank you so much for joining me on the show this week.
It's great talking to you, Diane.
All right. Have a good one.
Bye, Shauna.
Bye-bye. Bye, Cassie.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Diane.
Cassie Schumacher joined me right here in the studio. Shauna Hogan from her home in California. Two amazing women. Very exciting to have them here. Very exciting to hear their stories. And Cassie still continues to raise funds for her Wounded Warrior Project, which is really awesome. So that's our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. Tomorrow, watch the tour as they march down the Champs-Élysées and around the Arc de Triomphe, and we'll see who comes in second, third, fourth, and fifth. Congratulations to Chris Froome. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.